is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Mark Haney. Later in the program, we'll talk about the new Findlay Market District. Just one retail store is open now amidst a number of vacant buildings. We'll talk about what's possible for the area. But first, social media. It's infiltrated our lives over the past decade. Not only does it link us to friends and family, but it provides a connection between some who would not ordinarily have any reason to be in touch, from lawyers and clients to defendants and judges. Joining me today is author of Social Media in a Nutshell, University of Dayton School of Law Professor Thaddeus Hoffmeister. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, emailing talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for being here today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Marianne.
I want to let everyone know that although that you teach at the University of Dayton, you live in Wyoming, and you wanted to make a comment.
Yes, Marianne. I just wanted to give my condolences to the Otto Warmbier family and just let them know that my heart and mine is with them as they struggle through this time that they're going through.
We will have more information about the funeral services for Otto Warmbier coming up this afternoon on All Things Considered, so you can listen for that. Moving on to the whole idea of social media and how it affects people's lives, you've decided to write this book. When did you first notice, or when would you say the whole problem of social media actually being a problem more than just a communications tool came about?
Well, Marianne, for me, the first what I started noticing is the impact it was having on jurors. I started off my career looking at the jury system, and what I noticed more and more was that courts were struggling with maintaining and controlling how jurors use social media. And so that really drew me, and that's when I first started seeing some of the problem areas that are arising.
Give us some examples. What happens with jurors and social media that can cause problems?
Well, jurors are makeup of our community, and they reflect what's going on in society. And as people get more and more attached to their devices and using social media, it becomes difficult for them to draw away. And so what we saw was you saw a variety of different issues arising, one being some jurors could not sit there 8 hours without looking at social media. So you had that issue. But the more problematic problem that you saw were jurors accessing information online about the case, whether it be just social media or the internet as a whole. And that's when the problems started arising. And what you saw is you started mistrials. And then you also saw ways of people contacting and reaching out to jurors and in a way influence them in the decision-making process.
So that happens. Who would reach out to the jurors? Who would contact them?
Their friends. Their jurors who would actually hold a poll asking their friends which way they should vote on a verdict. You had people would have it back and forth. You know, sometimes when I've traveled the country giving presentations, and I would tell folks, I would say, just go on Twitter and run the search jury duty and see what comes back. You have people tweeting about their experience on jury duty. And so for some
while folks, it's still going on.
Yes, while it's going on. And what happens then is their friends want to talk to them about the jury duty. And so it gets this interaction, this dialogue that shouldn't be there that can influence the outcome of a case.
Well, don't the judges warn the jurors that they can't have that kind of communication?
Yes, they do. The judges do do their best. But for a lot of folks, the biggest challenge is how do you enforce your instructions? And I think that's one of the challenges that judges have is how can we get jurors to adhere to the requirements? And without that piece, you know, without that carrot, so to speak, you don't have jurors following the instructions. And even then, I think the problem, even if you did have a carrot, some way to enforce it, I think one of the problems you see is that many jurors, especially younger ones, are raised with these devices. They're raised with the internet. So they don't see it as a problem. They don't see it as a big issue for them to talk about certain aspects of the case with their friends and family. And so unless you can bring it to them and tell them why. If they don't buy in, if the jurors don't buy into why it's a problem, it's very difficult for them, the judge, to get jurors to adhere to this rule.
Was that true years ago before social media, where people wanted to go home and talk to their spouse or talk to their neighbors about what they'd done all day?
Well, no, Marianne, you're exactly right. I think the problem was always there. I don't believe that people actually went home. You know, you go to your spouse and your spouse asks you, how was your day? And you say, I can't talk about it. I don't really think that was a realistic view of what jurors did. I think they did talk to their spouses, and I think the legal system just accepted that. The problem today is now you have a digital trail that you can see and you can verify whether or not they did talk to other people. But even more problematic is the fact that other people can tap into that digital trail, and that's what attorneys will do. They want to know. So there's a flip side to this. As jurors talk or discuss the case, attorneys listen. Attorneys want to know the feelings jurors have. And so when they leave that trail, it allows for other people then to pick up on that trail and to find out what the specific views of those jurors are.
So, for example, that could change their closing argument if they know there's a particular sticking point that a juror has or something like that in a case.
No, you're exactly right. So, you know, this happens this happens right now, whether the juror talks about the case or not. Attorneys will actually investigate jurors online beforehand. And they do it for a variety of reasons, but one, for the point that you just raised, they want to bond with the jurors. You know, attorneys don't want impartial jurors. Attorneys want jurors who are going to favor their client, whether the client be the plaintiff or the defendant. So if they find out you are a big environmentalist, if they find out you're someone who's strong NRA, they may tap into that in their closing argument. They may try to make that bond because attorneys want jurors to like them. And so if they know information about them, they may use that when they appear before those jurors.
Now, everybody has a social – not everybody. Most everybody has a social media trail of some kind, whether it's pictures of your kids and a birthday party or more political or more opinionated types of comments. As a jury is being seated, are lawyers allowed to go look at those Facebook profiles, Twitter comments as part of the process, or is that not allowed?
No, I think you're right. I'm glad you mentioned that. I saw a statistic where they said 90% of two-year-olds have a digital trail. And I was like, well, they're not even on social media. Well, they're parents. See, so you start raising children on social media. And so you're right. A lot of people, whether they know it or not, they may be on social media even if they don't have a so-called Facebook account, because someone can put information out there. A third party can do that. And so, yes, for the most part, attorneys, most jurisdictions, it varies somewhat, but most jurisdictions allow attorneys to investigate jurors online. Now, there's a few anomalies that I've seen out there where some courts have said that if you're going to investigate these jurors, you have to give them notice, and then that has caused some attorneys to back away because they may not come across well if the jurors know they're doing this. But for the most part, most jurisdictions allow that. Now the caveat or the concern here is when you do that, you can't contact the jurors, so you can only look at public information. And thus, you couldn't friend a juror. An attorney can never do that, cannot friend a jury. Now, what makes this even more complex then is what if the social media provider provides the contact? So an example would be, oh, I want to know what that juror is tweeting. I want to follow that juror. So I sent a follow request on Twitter. So what happens is Twitter then contacts the juror. So then asks the question, did you, attorney, contact that juror? And so some jurisdictions will say, yes, you contacted because the third party acted on your behalf. Other jurisdictions say, no, you didn't contact. It was a third party. So it can get a little complicated. But that's another example of the law has not caught up with these changes in technology.
Well, let's talk about the law. Are there new laws being considered right now to sort of deal with all of these social media issues?
Oh, no, all the time and in a variety of areas. So we've just touched on the jurors, but there's one of the latest, they're just a law now yesterday, the United States Supreme Court struck down the social media ban on sex offenders in North Carolina. So there's a concern, rightfully so in my mind, about the ability of sex offenders to contact children. And we have a heightened concern because with social media, you do that away from the parents, and you can have the opportunity to groom a child without a parent knowing this. And so some states have passed laws that prohibit registered sex offenders from going on social media. The problem here, though, is because social media is so pervasive that, like the Supreme Court found, this law violates the First Amendment. So you have laws in that area. You have laws in the case to, you know, what happens to you when you pass away? What happens to your Facebook account? Can you give that to a loved one? Does it pass? Can you put it in your will? So those are the kind of things that are cropping up. These things that have always been around, but how do we apply this to this new technology of social media? So they're constantly re-looking our laws and seeing, do we need new ones? How do we address revenge porn? Do we need specific laws to target that? Do we
describe what that? What's revenge porn?
Oh, so revenge porn can take at least two forms. Three forms. There's one where a person hacks into someone's account, someone's Yahoo or Gmail account, finds nude photos and then distributes them. But that can generally be prosecuted because you can't hack someone's account. So there's laws covering that. There's another one where – there's another form of it where you surreptitiously take photos of people and then post them online. Again, there's laws to target that. The big area – the concern is – excuse me. When someone willingly gives over a nude or semi-nude photo to a loved one and then when that relationship turns sour or they break up – the loved one then posts that photo on a social media account or some other website, and that becomes very challenging then for the victim because generally it's female, but not always female. We had a case here in Cincinnati mm-hmm. that involved a male doctor who was actually a victim of revenge porn.
They originally gave that picture.
Willingly.
Right.
Yeah. And so that's one of the challenges there is, do we need specific laws to target that behavior when someone willingly gives a photo to another person and they use that photo in a harmful way that person who gave the photo didn't expect?
We are talking this afternoon about social media and the law in just a moment. And later in the program, we'll hear about the new Finley Market District as well. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We're talking about social media and how people are using it in ways that can affect the law. My guest is author of Social Media in a Nutshell, University of Dayton School of Law Professor Thaddeus Hoffmeister. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, emailing talk at wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and time is somewhat limited. So if you have a question you want to get that in, I would make that call now, 513-419-7100. We've talked a lot about jurors. We've talked about sex offenders. We've talked about lawyers. One group of people we haven't talked about are judges. So tell me what kind of precaution a judge needs to take when dealing with social media.
Well, Marianne, one of the challenges for judges is that I think, and it's interesting, it applies pretty much across the board, but it's this idea that you have to think of the long-term consequences of when you post content. And so what I've seen, surprisingly, is even judges run afoul of the rules because they forget what they're posting is going to eventually possibly be for the eyes of the world. And I think they run afoul of the rules because they forget this concept. It's one of these things, you know, When you're posting and you're looking at a smartphone or you're looking at a laptop, you're not thinking about the thousands, the tens of thousands, the possible millions of people who could see this. You know, Facebook has close to 2 billion users. So there's always a risk that you're going to post something that maybe from your eyes, it seems normal and appropriate, but in the eyes of someone else, taken in a different context can be offensive. And judges, we place on a higher standard. We expect them to be impartial and neutral. And what I've seen is that not all judges are that way. And there's a digital trail to show this. So there is that concern of upholding the judiciary. Another issue is their connections with lawyers. So one of the challenges, an interesting point that has come to has come about across the country is that half of the jurisdictions of this country do not allow judges to become friends or social media or other Facebook friends with attorneys if they appear before them. Now, the other half takes a completely different view, to include the state of Ohio, and they allow them to friend attorneys. So it's interesting to see the divide here, because those who don't allow feel that this somehow gives an impression of favoritism. And I think for those jurisdictions who don't allow it, I think part of the problem is just a lack of familiarity. In my view, Facebook has sort of redefined what constitutes a friend. And so so those jurisdictions that say you can't be friends put a lot of strength or a lot of power behind this concept of friend. But for some people, that friending someone on social media is nothing. They don't even know who they are. They couldn't identify them in person. So to put the connotations that they do on being a Facebook friend, to me, is somewhat misguided. But nonetheless, there are a number of jurisdictions around the country who say that judges and attorneys that appear before them, they cannot be friends.
What about if I think you've cited some examples of a case where a juror or a defendant or a litigant of some sort contacts a judge through social media? What happens then?
And that's kind of brings me to this two points, Marianne. One is that I just spoke to a group of judges, and I told them that, you know, I was just talking about the power of social media. And for them, especially those who are in contested elections, there's, outside of going door to door, there's no better way to meet your constituents than through social media. So in a way, they kind of need, in my view, to have a social media account, especially a Facebook page, to be able to reach out to those who are going to vote for them. The challenge then is when they have this page is then they have to safeguard that page, because if someone writes or says something inappropriate, that may be they may think the judge feels that way. So they have to monitor that page. And on the flip side, they also have to ensure that individuals don't contact them, and they can only do so much. So there's examples of witnesses attempting to friend the judge, or even some of the parties attempting to friend the judge. And so a judge has to, he or she has to be aware that depending on the jurisdiction, but you can never, a witness and a judge should not be Facebook friends. They should not interact. But you have to be on alert to that, to know that they shouldn't have these sort of ex parte communications. So although there's a lot of benefits of having a social media account, they also come with some responsibility. So judges have to be alert to that and to ensure that there's no inappropriate contact between them, a witness, or a juror on social media.
And that's far more complicated than it was 25 years ago, just because it's so much easier with social media. Because, I mean, somebody could go knock on the judge's door, I suppose, or see him in a restaurant.
Or
her in a restaurant.
You're exactly right. There's a case out of Iowa where a witness, a star witness, said happy birthday to the judge. It was his birthday. Now, 25 years ago, if a witness said happy birthday, judge, no one would make anything of it.
Or they wouldn't even know.
Wouldn't even know. Exactly. They wouldn't even know. But now they post that happy birthday on his Facebook page. And so now the world knows. And so now allows people to say, well, maybe the judge is not impartial. Maybe he favors this witness because they've said happy birthday. So it leads to a lot more questions. But in that example, they said, you know, just one posting is not going to be enough. But nonetheless, it's one more thing that a judge has to be aware of and to safeguard against, that these inappropriate comments that sometimes people do. But in passing, we've been nonplussed about that 25 years ago.
Our phone number is 513-419-7100 if you have a question or a comment. Nicholas is calling from Cincinnati. Hi, Nicholas. What's your question?
Hi, how are you doing? I'm a student of sociology, and I was wondering, I know that we have these safeguards to stop the judge from speaking with witnesses as well as some of the opposing attorneys. These safeguards, who's governing these safeguards, and how do we know that they're enforced adequately, and that those are just some of the questions that I have.
Okay. Well, Nicholas, thank you for your question. That is a challenge. There's no other party looking at what's going on in the courtroom. And what we rely on our legal system is the appellate process. And so if you feel that, which was in one case in Florida, if you feel that that there is an improper influence between a judge and and a party or a witness, you can then appeal that. One of the parties could appeal that or ask for a motion for the judge to be recused, and the next higher court will look at that and make a determination whether or not that judge should stay. And in one case in Florida, a defendant found that the judge was Facebook friends with the prosecutor and felt that the judge, and because of that, was not impartial. And I could see that from a pro se defendant. This person did not have counsel, and he was being prosecuted for a crime. I could see how someone, a layperson, can say, hey, this is, I'm not Facebook friends with the judge, and the prosecutor is. That's an unfair advantage. That's not, the judge is going to lose his partiality, or he's going to become partial, and it's going to be, we're not going to have a fair playing ground that I'm on.
Nicholas, thanks for your call. Our number, 513-419-7100. Lee called from Hamilton and said, why can't courts confiscate cell phones of jury members in court, or do they do that already?
Well, that's a great question, Lee. I will say when I first looked into this, that was the first thing that courts relied on, is confiscating the phones. What I've seen over time, though, it becomes basically a logistical nightmare. You see that happen in some of the very high-profile trials, like the recent Cosby trial. But the challenge here is, if you looked around as of late, you know, you're hard pressed to find a payphone. And so then the courts become responsible for ensuring that the jurors are in touch with the people they need to be. And as we grow closer and closer to our smartphones, and, you know, and today you don't even need to bring your wallet anymore, just as long as you have your smartphone, because everything you need is on it. So when you take that device away from a juror, then it becomes the court's responsibility to ensure that they maintain contact with the people they need to reach. And that becomes very challenging for the courts to do. So although I think it on the first blush, it looks like a good idea, I think it becomes very difficult to carry out in the long term. And so I think at this point, most jurisdictions limit taking the smartphone only when they're actually deliberating. But on a day-to-day basis, they won't do that. And another thing I think it's somewhat problematic is, I think that it somewhat treats jurors like children, because everyone else in there, all the decision makers, are using a smartphone. The judge has a smartphone. The attorney has a smartphone. So why aren't we allowing those who decide whether or not someone's liable or not liable, guilty or not guilty, why are we not taking away their devices? Because we don't trust them. We can't treat them as an adult. So I think you're going to probably see that less and less, and they're more and more going to hope that jurors can adhere to the rules.
Amy from Montgomery called in. She says she served on a murder trial and the defendant was identified online on Facebook, and that photo was used during the trial. Is that common?
More and more, Marianne. You see that. Now, the challenge here, I don't want to get into the weeds too much about the evidentiary issues, but if you do an ID off of something you see online and that's how you made the ID, then they'd have to admit that into evidence, and that brings up a whole nother, some other issues. But you see it more and more. I've seen it in a number of cases where they have linked people. They go through when the police are investigating someone, and they can't get a proper ID, but they know one person. I've seen this especially in a gang related crime. They will go through that person's friends, the number of friends they have, and then look at each picture and bring that to someone and say, "Do you recognize this person?" So more and more police are using social media to investigate and apprehend suspects.
And that's legal?
Yes, yes.
What about in terms of employees and employers and how all of that is regulated? You hear the case recently about, I can't remember the college, if it was Yale or Harvard, where a bunch of students that were accepted to college mm-hmm. were then said, no thanks, that offer was rescinded because of things that they found on those students' social media.
Yeah, and I want to answer that, but I just want to just clarify one point when you asked me if that's legal. Yes, it is legal as long as the police are properly in their social media account. So the police can't, without a warrant, go on to your Facebook page, but if you friend them, or if one of your friends grants them access, then they're okay without getting a warrant. More and more about an employer. One of the concerns some people have is that, this happens at the university as well on the job, is that jobs will research your social media account, and so they will look at the public account. Now, one of the challenges: can they access your private account? Can they force you, as part of employment, to grant them access to your personal account, make you open it up, or what they call shoulder surfing, go behind you and make you open up your Facebook account and read it? states across the country have passed laws prohibiting that. And so I don't think it happens in a lot of cases, but there's been enough where states have passed laws prohibiting employers from doing that. The challenge the employer has is that if they do dig into someone's social media account, is that they're setting themselves up to be challenged if the person doesn't get the jobs, if they look at the wrong thing, because you're limited when you don't hire someone, you can't, you know, I didn't hire you because of your religion, because of your gender, because you're pregnant. Well, many of those things you don't know when you first look at an application. But when you look at someone's social media account, I know what religion they are. I know their race. I know their gender. I know their age. I know so much more about them. Now, if you base a hiring decision on that, you could be in trouble. You could run afoul of the law.
How could somebody prove that?
That would be difficult. But if they get to a stage when you bring a claim, if you had information, then you get to the stage of discovery. If they could get to a discovery stage, and then they could ask, okay, well, I want to see the process you went through, the hiring process you went through. There's going to be a trail on whether or not you went in that social media account.
And that could make a difference.
Yeah, and that could make a difference.
Does that mean that people with social media accounts should lock them down a lot tighter, make them as private as possible, or does that even help?
I definitely think you want to adhere to all every privacy application you can do. I highly recommend that. I'm also a big proponent of using social media, but I also think you need to take safeguards. And I would use every privacy application strength that I could use on any form of social media, because I think it's important that you limit who can see your account and who can access your account.
I just want to ask one quick question before we run out of time. And it's come up with the case with Ray Tenzing now that the jury is deliberating. At least as we went in at 1 o'clock, the jury was still deliberating in that case. And one of the things that I think many people may be aware of is there is a lot out there on social media, people talking about that case, but also calling for protests. There's information about protests or demonstrations, some people complaining about the way police were treated, all those sorts of situations. Does that affect a case?
Well, it does, because I think it's very hard. Before, they would say to you, the judge would say to the jurors, you know, don't read a newspaper, don't watch the television, don't listen to the radio. But now you can't go on your social media page, your Facebook page, because you'll see a news feed that they may see information, or you may have friends telling you what's going on. So I think it's much harder to limit what jurors see on a daily basis. And also too, another issue is that with social media, you can organize protests much easier. I mean, that's one way they have flash mobs, is because they're using social media to meet at one place and then to engage in certain conduct. So
a lot faster than the old-fashioned phone tree.
Much, exactly right. So that's another concern that folks have is how quickly information will move with social media.
Thank you so much for being here. We could talk the whole hour about this, maybe two. I don't know. I appreciate you being here today.
Thank you for having me, Marianne.
We've been talking social media and the law. My guest today was author of Social Media in a Nutshell, University of Dayton School of Law, Professor Thaddeus Hoffmeister.